Now I'll call on our speaker tonight, Malcolm Shrimpton, to deliver his address, Environmentalism and the Bible.
Within today's society, there's a real movement away from the Bible and away from the church generally. And one of the main groups which seems to be spearheading this move away from the Bible are what are called environmentalists. Now, the interesting thing about this whole movement is that it's working its way into school curriculums and so forth, and so it's gradually becoming accepted as dogma. So I think it useful to look a little bit at this whole concept of environmentalism and ask whether or not the claim that they make, that the Bible is indeed responsible for many of the problems which this earth faces in this day and age, and to say then, should we then reject the Bible? Because the Bible itself is responsible for the destruction of habitats, the destruction of the earth as we know it, for an enlarging carbon footprint, as we talk about nowadays, and all those other things that we're supposed to be concerned about in the upcoming election. Well, the environmentalist argument goes something like this. They go back to the section of Scripture which was read to you and to introduce this topic, the first chapter of Genesis, the last about third of the first chapter of Genesis. And in that verse, in that section, in two places in the King James Version, there is the word dominion. And God gave man dominion over this, that, and the other. And so the environmentalist says, particularly if you look up the Hebrew underneath that word, which is translated dominion, you find that it very really means control. It means that you have the ability to do what you will with it. It is yours. In fact, in two or three other places in the first and second chapter of Genesis, God uses the phrase, I give you. And things in nature are given to human beings. Notably, the herbs are given for food, which is the principal use of that term. Things have been given to us on this earth by God. It's our dominion. It's ours to use as we will. Now, the next step in the argument, which usually comes from the ethicists, is that God then doesn't care what you do with it. God's given it to you, and God will let you do what you will with it. God doesn't care what you do with it. So that, of course, raises at least three questions. Number one, is it the Bible which has caused this? Number two, is it the correct use of the word dominion, which is responsible for the problems that we have in our society? And number three, is it true that God doesn't care what we do with the world around us? I think it's fascinating that if you actually analyze what's being said, it doesn't make sense. It was interesting today. I was just getting tidied up before I came down here, and Josie said something to me that I hadn't thought of before. She said, you know, we used to say, waste not, want not. People don't say that anymore. And quite interestingly, I had a grandmother who had more sayings for more things than you can imagine. And that was one of her sayings, waste not, want not. And she used to pound things like that into my poor little head. That if I didn't take care of what I had, I would regret it in the future because there would be a day when I would need these things. She used to tell me to walk both ways before I crossed the road and a whole host of other things. And the message that she was trying to drive into my poor little skull was that I was responsible for my own well-being. I was responsible for my future, and I had better think ahead, and I had better take care of what I've been given now. Suzuki probably never had a grandmother. He probably never had one, certainly, who said things like that to him. Because if he had, he would have realized that the previous generations, the ones who went to church, the ones who read their Bibles, were very frugal. We used to laugh at Scottish Presbyterians and Calvinists because that was so much a part of their creed. The things that God had given them should be treasured, should be cared for, should be looked after. The generation that went to church believed in the principles of modern environmentalism, that we should not overuse, that we should be careful how we use things, that it was our responsibility to use things with discretion. It was our responsibility not to abuse and overuse. But let's just leave that aside, because what we really do have to face is the fact that almost everybody accepts this argument, that because human beings have been given dominion, our Western society has felt it was quite justified in projects like the tar sands, which are completely transforming the environment in northern Alberta, and many other projects. If you've ever looked at a mine and the mine tailings, you'll realize what a mess is left behind. It's our right to take these things, we believe it's our right, say the environmentalists. It's because of the Bible that we believe this. So therefore, we should discard our Bibles and we should develop a set of ethical principles for ourselves. So, let's have a look. Let's have a look at what's really said here. Is it true that God has given us complete control of everything? Is it true that there are no restrictions placed by God on how we use these things? Is it true that God doesn't care what we do with this earth on which we live? We'll take these questions one at a time. First of all, it is quite clear from this second portion of the first chapter of Genesis that God told human beings to multiply, to replenish the earth. He told human beings that we do have dominion over the fish of the sea, as it is in the 26th verse. We do have dominion over every fowl of the air and living thing that moveth, as it says in the 28th verse. We have been given every herb bearing seed, as it says in the 29th verse. But what does it say in the last verse, in the 31st verse? It said God saw everything that he had made, as the words are in my translation, and behold, it was very good. In other words, when God had formed this earth, when he had given us the landforms which we enjoy, the mountains that form a backdrop and the forests that clothe them, the streams that run down them and the waterfalls that you can walk beside and enjoy the sound of the water. When God had put the animals in those places, when God had given us domestic animals to support our societies, and when God had given us all of the cereal grains and all of those things which we take so much for granted and we eat each day, and the fruits and vegetables that in our day and age can come from as far away as the other half of the right half way around the world. And God put people into that setting for the first time. God liked what he saw. May I use that term for the 31st verse? God liked what he saw. Well now, so we've been given all these things, all these animals and plants and surroundings. What are we going to do with them? Well, what's the next thing that happens when you work your way through Genesis? What's the next encounter that human beings have in Genesis as it is explained to us here? Well, God placed man in a garden, not just in a wilderness area. There was an area which was cultivated somehow. And people were put in, and Adam was put in that surrounding. And God looked at what was there and he said, well, got to organize this a little bit. And so God brought every one of the animals to Adam, and Adam named them. Now, you see, that's the first element of actually having a level of control. That's the first element of having something in your purview, in your domain, in where you live. You name, you label your front room, you label the furniture which is there. So if you're talking to somebody else, they know what you're talking about. It's a table versus a chair and so on. If you have a pet dog, you give it a name and it has a species and you can describe it. We name things as our right when they're part of our domain. And that's what happened with Adam. And if you look at the order in which these animals are presented, it's presented as cattle, as domestic animals, in other words, and then fowl of the air, and then the beasts of the field. So we go from domestic animals to wild animals and include the flying creatures. And Adam gave names to all of them. And they were part of the environment in which God placed Adam. And Adam exercised his right of domain to give them names. What was the next thing that happened? Well, quite interestingly, God said to Adam, well, you're in this garden. You can eat anything, but there's one tree that I want you to leave alone. And it just so happened that the human pair didn't leave that tree alone. And it just so happened then that God came to them and said, what have you done? And the aftermath of that was that God clothed them with skins. Now, usually when Christadelphians get going on this topic, we pick up the religious aspects of this, and we talk about sacrificing an animal because of the sin that had taken place and so forth. I want to leave that whole aspect alone for the time being and concentrate on, remember, we're talking about environmentalism and talking about the criticisms that come to us from environmentalists. So let's just focus on the physical aspects of this. God was saying that these animals are yours in that second chapter. And you can give them names, Adam. But God was now saying that you may use the animal skins to protect yourself, to cover yourself, to keep yourself warm. You see, as human beings, we need three things to stay alive. We have to breathe. We need food and water. And we need some form of shelter. We need to maintain our body heat. These basic elements are laid out for us here in the first three chapters of Genesis. That we have the animals as part of our purview, the animals and plants. They provide us with the food and sustenance. The atmosphere is there all along. And God is now saying you may also use these animals for the other very basic need that you have. And that is to shelter yourself, to cover yourself, to keep yourself warm. As I said, we'll leave aside completely all of the theological, all of the religious arguments, which are certainly part of this, and look at the physical, which is going on here. We are being given things for our basic needs. What's the next interaction that we have with animals when we work our way through Genesis? Well, it's the time when Cain and Abel brought an offering before God. Cain brought the fruits of the field. He brought grains and cereal, root crops and whatever. We don't know. But he brought plant material. That's quite clear. The other offering was of animals. And God accepted the animal offering. And God told Cain, who had brought the plant offering, that his offering was unacceptable. So we're being given another element here of the permissible use of animals, which we have here in Genesis. Firstly, for food. Secondly, for shelter, for support, for clothing. And thirdly, to present as an offering to God to express our thanks for the life that we have been granted. Now, there are other things and in this whole matter of the offerings which are presented there, but we'll leave them alone for the time being, and we'll go back to the environmentalists and consider what they say. Nowadays, we're signing treaties forever with the First Nations, as they are officially called nowadays. And these people are permitted to take, say, salmon out of the streams for two reasons. One, for food, and two, for ceremonial purposes. And the environmentalists accept all of this. This is the right thing to do. For food, for basic needs, and for ceremonial purposes. If we think in terms of what God asks of us, we are no longer asked physically for animal sacrifices, but we are asked to give something of ourselves back to our God. And that was the principle which was there in the offerings that Abel presented. In other words, this world in which we live is here to sustain us, and it's here to give us enough resources that we can offer something back to God, to recognize that we are the handiwork of God, that our life has been given to us by God. There's a very interesting little phrase at the end of the 6th chapter of Matthew to take this whole idea and shoot it forward into the New Testament. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. And if you look at the phraseology and the Greek words and so forth, what's obviously meant there is that if we spend a lot of time trying to get, we take from the time that we should be given to God. So what we really need to do is make sure that we have enough to sustain us, but not so much that it is impinging on what we owe to God. So once again, the principle, whether we look at it in the Old Testament here from Genesis or whether we look at it from the New Testament, is that we are given enough and we are allowed enough to maintain us, to sustain us, to keep us in health and strength. But rapacity and any other form of excess is not condoned here in the early chapters of Genesis or anywhere else in our Bibles. Well, it's all right to approach things that way, but we said that the argument presented by the ethicists, at any rate, is that God doesn't care what you do. We've been given dominion, and God doesn't care what you do. What that indicates is that God has not set any restrictions on us. God hasn't set any boundaries on our behavior. What we've got and what we can get is what we are able to grab onto, in other words, according to the ethical argument. And we shouldn't do that simply because it's wrong. We should not do it and for any other reasons. And the Bible itself will permit us to behave that way. As we have said, that's not primarily what's there. But the other question which we raised for you is, does God present restrictions, limitations on what we do? Second chapter of Genesis. See, we haven't even got going in any more than about 50 verses in the Old Testament yet, and we're answering all these questions. Does God present limitations on what we should do? Genesis 2, and if you start halfway down it, about verse 16, you'll find that God set man in a garden, set Adam in a garden, and God said to Adam, look, all these trees here, you can eat anything you like from any of those trees, but there is one that you must leave alone. There's one tree that you've got to leave alone. Right there in Genesis, there was a restriction on human behavior. What did humans do? Well, they looked at the tree and they said, there's no reason why we should leave that one alone. Just look at the quality of the fruit on it. What do you do when you go to the to Thrifties and look at the produce? What do you do? You say, hey, that's a good looking leek or cabbage or apple or whatever you're buying. Those are good ones. Those are not so good. I'm not going to bother with those. We do that. And it was done in Genesis. Nowadays, we're bombarded with the eat properly syndrome. Nutritional information is coming out of our ears. That was the next thing there in the decision to eat the fruit of this forbidden tree. Looks good. And it's nutritious. And not only that, it's going to be a whole new experience for us. We're going to learn something from what we're doing. It will broaden our horizons, as we might say nowadays. When you transpose what happened in Genesis into today's thinking, you get right back to what we do on an everyday basis. People haven't changed. And the story that we have here in Genesis is exactly the same thing that goes through our minds every time we go shopping. So why should we see anything wrong with what's done? But the thing that was wrong was that they stepped outside what God had allowed them. There were prohibitions. God was concerned with what people did, with what he had created to sustain those people. It wasn't true. It is not true that God does not care what we do with his creation. When we get a little further into the law of Moses, we begin to see these things in a little more detail. I want to look at some of the food laws with you for a few moments. And look at just one section particularly. I want to look at the 11th chapter of Leviticus. And we're going to look at a section in the center of this chapter. This part of Leviticus expands on the prohibitions that the Israelites had as a nation of what they should eat and what they should not eat. Now, there has been a great deal written in the past over the health aspects of the prohibitions in the law of Moses. Pigs, for instance, carry parasites which infect humans in a very severe fashion. And so you have to be very careful how you handle pork. And that was known, and people have pointed this out and said that there were very good and sufficient reasons for the prohibitions which were in the law of Moses on the grounds of human health. And that one has been worked for a long time, very extensively. But what I want to do is look at the environmental side of this evening. In the 11th chapter of Leviticus, and it starts in the 13th verse, we have a list of birds. And these birds are cited as an abomination. Now, another place where this word abomination occurs is from meat sacrifices which were eaten by the priests. When they got into the third day, the priests were no longer permitted to eat them. And nowadays we know very well that there are good and sound health reasons. We have 13 people die in Canada over the last month or so because of this very thing, that things were allowed to incubate bacteria and last a little long, and then were eaten after they had become a mess of infectious material. And so that, again, is cited many times in Moses. But when you look at this list of birds which we have here, starting in the middle of Leviticus 11, there's no reason not to eat any of them, not on those grounds. Now, I have a copy of a Jewish translation of the scriptures, and this makes a little note that some of the Species which you mentioned there cannot be identified for certain, and we have to admit that. But the first three in the list can certainly be very clearly known. There's an interesting word in the King James Version, the ossifrage, the bone breaker, as it's called. It's a form of vulture, which is present in the Middle East. And then there's a smaller vulture, which is also listed there in the list. And then there are a whole series of raptors. I don't know what translation you've got. Some of the translations describe eagles in some of these places. Others don't. Some of them, the King James has the word swan in one place, and that's obviously wrong. There are owls, and some of them are correct. Some of them are not, and one of the translations uses the word bustard, which for one of the species towards the end of the list, which is a marsh bird and lives in areas which, are full of reeds and so forth. Why should we not eat these particular birds? Over the last 100 years, we have come to gain a lot of information in what is called population dynamics. We know how populations rise and fall. In the Gordon Head at the moment, you've got an overabundance of deer. And the reason for that is that there's a lot of food in people's gardens on the one hand, and secondly, there are no cougars in built-up areas. There's nothing to control the population of deer, nothing to keep them in balance. And this whole area of keeping populations in balance has been studied at great length over the last 100 years. We now know the benefits of keeping raptors, as they're called, eagles, kites, hawks. I'm not sure what words you have in your translation, but you'll find some of those words somewhere in this list. The raptors are very important for controlling populations of rodents and some populations of birds. The world would be a very different place. Plants would be in short supply. Birds would be dying of starvation if there were no other species to control them. That one which is in the King James Version, the ossifrage, is a large vulture. Specializes in carrying bones and objects up into the air and dropping them to break them and then picking the marrow and so forth out of the bones. Or shellfish, whatever it can get hold of that can break from a distance. They're scavengers. And they do a very important job in maintaining the health of the planet. Now, what's the other thing about all of these birds? Well, quite interestingly, we almost lost the peregrine falcon in this continent about 30 years ago. We nearly lost them to 2,4-D and herbicides of that nature, DDT particularly, because they accumulated in the food chain. When you have problems, whatever those problems may be, which start in the base of the food chain, they end up in these species which are responsible for maintaining the health of the wild populations on our planet. And the other thing is that species like this bone breaker, the California condor and the Andean condor and so forth, they get to be quite old before they're mature enough to reproduce. And when they do, their reproduction rate is very low. So if you start taking individuals out of a population, you're really restricting the ability of that population to maintain itself. We've learned all these things, many of them in the last 40 or 50 years, in the last 100. Leviticus was almost certainly written around 14 or 1500 BC. So 3,500 years ago, without explaining the reasons, God placed meaningful prohibitions on people's actions. God does care what happens in his world. And God made sure that people did not behave in a way which would damage, which would destroy the world that he had made. There's another two rather interesting little points I'd like to show you on this general topic, and they're in Deuteronomy. We're going to look first at Deuteronomy 22. We're going to look in the sixth verse. And the second, last few phrases in this verse are translated in all sorts of different ways, but the points that the verse makes, verse 6 makes, can't be mistaken, nonetheless. What's being stated here is that if, as you're walking, if you're moving, if you're going somewhere, out and about, as we might say nowadays, you come across a bird's nest, and in it there are eggs, it's permissible for you to take the eggs. You must not take the mother who is sitting on the nest. So two or three things are coming out of this. Firstly, that it's obviously not a domestic situation. We're stepping out of the domestic animals which were listed first when the animals were brought to Adam. We're stepping now into the animals which belong outside that sphere of domesticity. And it's stated that it is permissible for you to take from this sphere, which is outside the area of domestic animals. But you must be careful how to do it. Now, there are three things in this verse which stand up no matter which translation you're looking at. And the first one is that you're obviously out somewhere. It's not a purposeful walk. And the second is that because of that, it's then an accidental happening. So what's so significant about that? Why are you out there? And why is this accident fortuitous? That hinges on the last few words in this verse. And whatever your translation is, it's quite obvious that the meaning is that you should be sustained in a time of need. In other words, if your need is such to keep you alive, to sustain your life, and you find something, you may have it, but you must not destroy the surroundings, the ecology, the environment, the species in that action. It's permissible for you to eat when you need to, but not to the detriment of the world that God has made. We have to be responsible in what we do. We can't take more than is necessary to keep us alive. The last point on this general topic. When I was about 7 in England, they had a war going on, and air raid sirens were sounding most nights and bombs dropping and all of those things. It's not a very pleasant surrounding. But the other thing that was going on at the same time during the day was that people would come around with trucks or carts, horse and cart and whatever, and they'd take all the iron railings from in front of your house. They just took them. Now, I don't know, being about 7 at the time, whether anybody ever got paid for the iron that was taken. I don't know really what happened. I just remember people coming down, a horse and cart that came down our street, picking up all these bits and, the railings that separated one backyard from another, went on to the back of this truck, and they went off to support the war effort. You do all kinds of things when it is necessary to support your civilization in a time of war. You'll allow almost anything to go. You give up almost anything if it means winning in that situation. That must have been the same way of thinking for the Israelites. So when we read now in the two chapters earlier, at the end of the 20th chapter of Deuteronomy, when thou shalt besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them. And thou shalt not cut them down, for the tree of the field is a man's life. You shall not cut them down and employ trees that can provide for human life during, even if you feel you need this last piece of timber to batter down the door, which is the last structure in the city that you're besieging. You cannot use everything, even in a time of extreme need. Only the trees that thou knowest, that they be not trees for meat, those you can use. Now, in these days, of course, there were siege engines were built, and some of them, Alexander the Great, for instance, he built siege engines which were something like 120 feet tall when he was besieging Tyre. It was commonly done. It was essential. It was a way of getting the end that you needed. In war, you do things like that. Well, we started out by saying that the environmentalist argument is, generally speaking, that God gave man dominion over everything which is on the earth. And that then gives man the right to do what he likes with things on the earth. We then said that this argument, more often than not, includes the concept that God does not mind what you do. God doesn't care what you do with it. God doesn't place any prohibitions on what you do with it. And we then said that the conclusion presented by the environmental movement is that we should develop a whole new set of principles which are not based on the Bible, because the things that the Bible has given us have led to all kinds of damage on this earth. What we have suggested to you is that in the beginning, in Genesis, that what was really offered to man by this dominion which we were given over the things in the earth was the ability to maintain ourselves in health and strength, to keep ourselves alive, comfortably alive, but not more. What was offered to us is the ability to clothe and protect ourselves, but not to take to the extent of luxury. And what we have also suggested is that God gave us in this world enough that we could maintain our lives and have something left that we could give back to God. And then we went on to say that 3,500 years ago, God placed very real restrictions on human behavior with regard to the world in which we live. And in some instances, we are only just beginning to understand the wisdom of those restrictions. But it does show that God is concerned with what we do with his earth. It's quite interesting that what often happens next when the environmentalists are arguing is that they go to what we would sometimes call a primitive culture. And they say these primitive peoples have such a spiritual connection to the land. They have a very different way of looking at things. And wouldn't it be nice if we could transform our society to this same level of spirituality? What's forgotten in that argument is that most anthropologists will argue that the reason our society has developed the way it is because of the things which were available to us in our environment. The cereals, the grasses which we have, all hybridize easily. They all produce yields. They can all be selected and form the basis for agriculture. The animals which we find in the temperate zone throughout southern Europe, many of them can be readily domesticated. The horse, for instance. Whereas the comparable animal to the horse in Africa, the zebra, is almost impossible to do anything with. It's the resources in people's environments which have given rise to the developments in our societies. And that's the argument that the anthropologists offer. So what we're really saying is that if we were to switch these peoples, and 5,000 years ago, if we'd taken a group that was in a primitive situation in a jungle, put them into the Middle East, they would have been the progenitors of the society that we enjoy today. In other words, people are the same. And people develop according to the opportunities which are there before them. Now that point is made in the prophets, where Isaiah points out very clearly that the children of Israel did many things, including in their food laws, which were an abomination before God. And Ezekiel pleads to God, he said, they may have done this, but I have never violated the food laws. And so it is quite clear that even though this group of people who based their way of life on Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, even though that group of people based their lives on the things that we have been reading, when it comes down to it, they were no better than the rest of us in that they took what they wanted and they developed their societies the way they wanted and they ignored the restrictions which had been placed by God. But what does God intend? People are the same. We say that. Doesn't matter how many times you're told. We don't always listen. But what does God intend? Usually when Christadelphians start in the first chapter of Genesis, they are working on an argument which will show that God had a purpose with this earth, and it was set out in essence in the early chapters of Genesis. And that purpose works its way all the way through the Bible until it comes out to its end in its full fruition. There are two or three verses which indicate what God intends for the world, regardless of what human beings have done to it in the interim. And I want to show you a couple from Isaiah before we stop. Firstly, from the 41st chapter of Isaiah, we're going to start reading in the 18th verse. I will open rivers in high places, said God, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittar tree, the myrtle, and the oil tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand that the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. We may have a free hand with what we do with this earth now. But that's what God intends for the world in the final analysis. And look now at Isaiah 60, the 13th verse. The glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box together to beautify the place of my sanctuary. And I will make the place of my feet glorious. In Genesis, at the end of the first chapter, we read that God had finished his work and he looked around. And behold, it was very good. And we read again phrases that indicate that when God set man in the garden, that he was pleased with the outcome. And for the last several thousand years, man has been on his own. To either listen to the words from Leviticus that we should be careful of how we handle this environment that God has placed us in, or not as we choose. But ultimately, what God intends for the world is there in Isaiah. It's a repeat of what we saw in Genesis. God planted a garden and set creatures in it. And behold, it was very good.